Rudyard Kipling once wrote, "Oh, East is East, and West is West, and never the twain shall meet." But that all changed in the mid to late 1800s when thousands of immigrants flocked to the new frontier in search of an opportunity. A golden one, you might say. It started with the 1848 California Gold Rush. Soon, though, miners were seeking other states to find their fortunes. They arrived in South Dakota, on sacred Lakota land. As you might imagine, people stealing indigenous property caused quite a few skirmishes. By 1868, the Treaty of Fort Laramie ensured that everyone knew that the Black Hills of South Dakota belonged to the indigenous people already living there. But settlers thought that if the Lakota people considered the Black Hills sacred, it had to have some sort of value other than spiritual. Then, in 1874, Lieutenant Colonel George Custer found gold along the French Creek. Naturally, word got out and caused a sudden influx of fortune hunters. American and Chinese miners from California quickly set up camp that they named Deadwood after a number of fallen trees found in a nearby gulch. But Deadwood's reputation as a place of lawlessness grew as quickly as the population, which swelled to over 5,000. The next big growth spurt happened when a pair of brothers found one of the largest veins of gold-bearing ore in American history. As a result, Deadwood skyrocketed from 5,000 to 25,000. Murders became common, opium was freely traded, fights broke out regularly, and while settlers clashed with each other, they also had plenty of run-ins with the Lakota tribes and the Chinese prospectors. For familiarity and protection, these Chinese miners formed a tight-knit community that other settlers referred to as Chinatown. These immigrants established businesses that catered to the prospectors and others, including restaurants, laundries, and houses of gambling. It was East meets West, give and take, friend and stranger, all made possible by gold. I'm Aaron Mankey, and welcome to the Wild West. James Wilson Marshall had come to Coloma, California from New Jersey in search of work. He'd been hired to build a water-powered sawmill for his boss, John Sutter. The job wasn't easy, but at least he was paid, unlike the Native Americans that Sutter enslaved. Sutter controlled the colony and everyone in it. Marshall spotted something shining in the riverbed at the base of the Sierra Nevada Mountains on a clear January day in 1848. He scooped out a handful and stared at the gold flakes. To his delight, the whole bed sparkled with gold. At first, Marshall and Sutter tried to keep the discovery a secret, which meant that before long, everyone along the entire western coastline knew about it. In San Francisco, storekeeper Sam Brannan debated only a day or two before setting out to see if the rumors were true. And they were. Brannan returned with a vial of gold flake. Not long after that, he was wealthy. But his fortune didn't come from the gold. It came from selling shovels and other tools to prospectors. By mid-June, most of the city's male population had bought supplies and headed to Coloma in search of gold. By August, 4,000 prospectors had gone, each seeking to strike it rich. Ships arrived from everywhere, Chile, Hawaii, Peru, and China. Those in Boston choosing to travel by ship had to take a 15,000-mile, 8-month trip. The journey by land was faster and shorter, taking 6 months in between 2,000 and 3,000 miles. But it wasn't without risk or hardship. Travelers faced steep mountains and swift river currents. Some faced starvation and attacks from indigenous people, and even other prospectors. Those on the East Coast could hardly believe the news coming from out West. It seemed too good to be true. A letter from one prospector to the editor of the Philadelphia North America read, "Your streams have minnows, and ours are paved with gold." In December, President James K. Polk confirmed in his State of the Union address that California did indeed have gold. Time was of the essence, though. Everyone knew that there wasn't enough for everyone to flock to California. Men abruptly left their jobs at factories and shops. They took their life savings and headed west, leaving their wives and families behind, promising to return once they had struck it rich. And this flood began to arrive in California by 1849, earning them the nickname the Miner 49ers. And as you might imagine, these mining towns boomed overnight. Shops, saloons, and gambling establishments all sprang up. Towns were overcrowded almost immediately and often without any sort of law enforcement, making them the perfect place for thieves and outlaws. Women who were left behind on the East Coast struggled to support their children or to work the farms. Finding employment outside the house was difficult. Even if they managed to find a place that hired women, the pay wasn't good enough to support an entire family. Some of these women made their way west to be with their husbands. Others believe that the move would offer a change of pace and a bit of adventure compared to their everyday lives back home. And then there were the women who saw a way to make their own fortunes in a town where everyone couldn't be a miner. Out west, jobs were more plentiful. They could be shopkeepers, cooks, and teachers, just to name a few. Others took a more entrepreneurial route, setting up boarding houses or becoming hotel proprietors. Due to the need for these services, women had more societal power than they did back out east. Out west, they could own property and run a business. But life wasn't all gold and riches. When people moved from one mining town to another, businesses failed as the populations moved on. And without access to as many doctors, illnesses and injury killed many of the new residents. In reality, those seeking a glamorous life were unlikely to find it. But as long as the mountains and rivers had gold, they would keep on trying. If there were fortunes to be had, people would keep coming, creating new opportunities, and then, of course, dashing those dreams. Chinese immigrants, which happened to be all men at that time, started out as entrepreneurs, while others worked for the miners. Discrimination kept them from living among the white residents, but they set up their own city within San Francisco. Like the area in South Dakota, the settlers there called it Chinatown. In 1849, 20-year-old Ah Toy stepped off a boat traveling from China. She was a foreign woman alone in a foreign land. San Francisco was already a bustling town. But like the Chinese men who came seeking gold, Ah Toy was determined to make her mark. It's unclear if the ship arrived from Hong Kong or another port. She arrived alone, although there seems to be a couple of theories about why that is. In one story, Ah Toy was the captain's mistress. He offered her safe passage and enough money to start a life in San Francisco. Another story is that her husband died during the travel, leaving her alone to navigate a new life on her own. Regardless of how she came to America, some believe that Ah Toy arrived with her feet bound, a common practice in China's upper classes. Where Victorian England coveted women with tiny waists, Chinese men preferred those with tiny feet. A foot size no more than 3 inches was prized the most. Those with feet longer than 5 inches or more were considered undesirable. Binding became a way of preventing women's feet from growing longer, although it also left them disfigured. With a new life came new freedom, and Ah Toy removed her bindings. Without a husband, she needed to find work, which wasn't exactly plentiful for women, especially minorities. But she managed to find employment with a trader who hired her as his servant. The gold rush brought thousands of immigrants from China. Soon enough, 1/3 of San Francisco's population was Chinese. American miners found the increasing numbers posed too much competition for the gold that they wanted. So in 1850, California enacted a law requiring all immigrants to pay a $20 per month foreign miner's license. Additionally, racial minorities, including Native Americans, Mexicans, African Americans, and Chinese immigrants, were limited in their right to vote, to own property, or even participate on juries. Marriages between races were absolutely prohibited. Mining became too expensive for Chinese miners, and those who stayed in the area had little choice but to find other ways to earn a living. One of the most common occupations was doing laundry for the prospectors. This allowed them to keep any gold dust or flakes that they found on the miners' clothing or in the washing water. Some of them, though, pivoted to other businesses, opening restaurants, gaming halls, retail shops, or shoe repair. A few ran opium houses or pharmacies. And those who still hoped to strike it rich left California for other states that did not require an expensive license. Black Hills, South Dakota became one of those popular destinations. But women in the West didn't have the same opportunities as men. Longing for a life that didn't continue to leave her in poverty, Ah Toy noticed how other women were earning a living. With limited opportunities, some of them had turned to sex work. She noticed that there was no shortage of men willing to pay, driving the price for their services higher than other forms of employment. Their lifestyle was purely for economic reasons. So the women kept the liquor flowing at saloons and dance halls. The average age of a customer there hovered around 20, although some were as old as 50. Others were just 13. Regardless of age, though, the women all had the same goals: make money, marry well, and get out of the business. This was more difficult, if not impossible, for minority women. Now, the number of men in relation to the available sex workers determine the price in a town. Sometimes the women made $10, or the approximate equivalent of about $400 today. At night, the women worked in bordellos. The money and the opportunity to find and marry a rich prospector brought in women from all over Europe. Atoy watched these women rise in society. The most beautiful European and American women worked in the better parlor houses and bought the finest dresses. They entertained the most influential and wealthiest men in San Francisco. Sex work was a profitable business in mining towns, but it was also dangerous. And while some women earned enough to make a fresh start elsewhere, Atoy realized that the real money was in the running of the brothel. She decided to set her goals high. One day, she would run a brothel of her own. But first, she needed money. Atoy set up her shop in a shack, just 4 feet wide by 6 feet tall, in Chinatown. Her slender body, good looks, and infectious smile allured many men. While most of her clients were minors, she kept some of San Francisco's social elite company as well, including a French writer living in the area and California's Senator David Broderick. Broderick's fixer, Charles Duane, was quoted as saying that Atoy was the finest-looking woman he had ever seen. And that made her stand out, which was important. San Francisco was home to nearly 25,000 people. Atoy, though, was the only Chinese sex worker in the city, which made her popularity grow. More Chinese women came in on steamships, and men lined the harbor streets to greet them. The women were auctioned to the highest bidders willing to pay for their services. For Atoy, business was more than good. In a year, she opened her own parlor, hiring Chinese women new to the city. San Francisco had plenty of brothels and enough customers to go around. San Francisco's first madam, Irene McCready, owned two previous establishments that burned to the ground. When she rebuilt a third time, she chose a brick building. And if they weren't going there, they were going to another famous madam, Belle Cora, who ran a posh bordello on DuPont Street. Now, there were other brothels in town, although perhaps not as stylish as McCready's or Cora's. The lesser establishments kept to the basics of furnishings: a washbowl, a chair, and a bed. Like the more upscale madams, Atoy wanted a more upscale business. Atoy's first parlor house opened on Pike Street. Instead of the basics, she insisted on stylish furniture and embroidered cushions. She was a shrewd businesswoman with a reputation for being tough, and frequently took clients who refused to pay right to court. The problem was that technically her establishment wasn't legal. So when Atoy took deadbeats to court, she had to choose her complaint carefully, citing failure to make appropriate compensation for services rendered. But it turned out that Atoy wasn't the only entrepreneur in Chinatown. Chinese gangster Yi Atai offered protection to businesses that paid him, and trouble for those who didn't. He should have known that when he tried to extort Atoy, she would fight back. Yi A demanded that Atoy pay him a protection tax, and she declined. If she wanted protection, she knew exactly where to find it. The police station was just down the street from her parlor. Although the court dismissed her lawsuit, Yi A quickly found himself behind bars for assault and grand larceny. When he was released a year later, he never bothered Atoy again. The law changed for Chinese immigrants in the mid-1850s. The taxes levied on immigrants and minorities forced many of them to move. Miners, fishermen, laundry operators, and brothel owners earned less income as a result. Atoy, who operated several brothels across the city, began to feel those effects. The source of her problems was a group of Protestant men who formed the San Francisco Committee of Vigilance in 1851. Their mission was to stamp out prostitution, along with other unregulated vices. Although they were a small subset of the city, they had connections with prominent and highly influential people in authority. In 1854, the city passed an ordinance against brothels. Mexican and Chinese brothels were the first to be shut down, and authorities arrested Atoy. She was released a short while later, but the city was changing. Soon there would be no more minority-owned brothels left. And then, in 1855, the gold rush officially ended in San Francisco. Although many of the better-known brothels managed to stay open, there was no longer room or clientele for entrepreneurs like Atoy. So she shuttered her business and returned to China. In 1860, San Francisco began reinventing itself from a Wild West mining town to something more upscale. Authorities cracked down even harder on Chinese brothels, passing 8 new codes against prostitution between 1866 and 1905. Chinese women were jailed for 5 days and fined upwards of $50. That's roughly $800 today. White sex workers, though, mainly seemed to be exempt. Ah Toy did return to the United States in 1860. Although she could no longer work in her former profession, she enjoyed the companionship of several long-term partners. And yet she never married any of them. Why? Well, laws known as anti-miscegenation laws prevented those in mixed-race relationships from marrying, and those laws remained in effect until 1943. More regulations and laws followed to curb the influx of Chinese laborers immigrating en masse to the United States. President Chester A. Arthur signed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, setting a 10-year ban on workers coming from China. Although she may not have come to the United States seeking gold, Ah Toy did earn a considerable fortune. She also made her mark on history. She was the second ever Chinese woman to arrive in San Francisco and became the first Chinese sex worker. It's said that miners often raced to her shanty and that the men standing in line wrapped around the block. Ah Toy had become San Francisco's first Chinese madam and opened several brothels. She managed to navigate life in one of Chinatown's most dangerous locations, too. Most brothels were tucked away in alleys with opium houses. As far as the city was concerned, if the establishments were not on the main roads, they would turn a blind eye. But there's a darker side to that. While many Chinese women who came to the United States to work in brothels did so willingly, others did not. You see, some were kidnapped back in China and then sold into the business. Then in America, brothel owners and wealthy men seeking a mistress would buy them at an auction. It was horrifying, an alternate version of slavery, and deeply dehumanizing. In the end, the crackdown on sex work ended Ah Toy's livelihood. And while many a miner lost and found a fortune during the gold rush, it seems that Ah Toy was wise with her money. Reportedly, she had earned and saved a considerable fortune. Ah Toy lived a quiet life after closing her business and disappeared from the spotlight. The last time her name was recorded, it was in the 1920s, to announce the news of her death. But she lived a life that stood out from the crowd. Like Belle Cora, Madame MacCready, and other women of the Wild West who were denied a way to earn a living, Ah Toy quickly learned how to command power and financial security in a strange new land. For them, the West was won with sex. The story of San Francisco and the Gold Rush certainly takes on a new appearance when viewed through the lens of the immigrants who played a key role. From service jobs to sex work, the Chinese experience was bleak, always uphill, and usually surrounded by prejudice. But of course, there's always more to the story. Stick around through this brief sponsor break to hear my teammate Ali Steed tell you one more tale from San Francisco.
In the years since the Gold Rush, Chinatown continued to grow, so much so that the boom in population would present a problem. Throughout the late 1890s, San Francisco's Chinatown had become a bustling neighborhood filled with shops, restaurants, and homes. That was all about to change, though, in March of 1900. 41-year-old Wong Chut King, a Chinese immigrant who had come to America nearly 2 decades earlier, wasn't feeling well. He worked hard at the lumberyard not far from his home. Home, however, was a generous word for his living conditions. The dank room he and several other men shared wasn't fit for the rats that frequently visited, much less other human beings. The men rented the space from the Globe Hotel on DuPont Street. Small and dank, the men took turns sleeping on the floor, and mere feet away, Wong and the others had dug a small pit to use as a toilet. They had no other options. Chinatown residents were busy celebrating the Lunar New Year, and, ironically, it was the year of the rat. Wong wasn't up for celebrating, though. He had come down with a fever, chills, and body aches. He consulted a Chinese doctor who could do little for the swollen lymph nodes in Wong's neck and groin. Soon, his fever raged higher, and he couldn't keep food down. Before long, he slipped into a coma and passed away. When the city's undertaker received his body, he faithfully reported Wong's symptoms, which prompted city health officials to come down and inspect the body. What they found horrified them. Wong had died from bubonic plague, and officials now had a problem on their hands. Board of Health members met and debated late into the night, finally deciding to quarantine Chinatown, hoping to stop the spread. The root cause of bubonic plague had only been discovered a few years prior. Until then, people believed that the plague was transmitted from germs through open wounds or food or even bad air. The real cause was a tiny bacterium spread by rats, or more precisely, the fleas that infested those rats. Within a week, 8 more people in Chinatown had died, though that number might have actually been higher. Doctors converged, going door to door searching for potential victims, but their search turned up empty. Doctors did report on the deplorable conditions families were living in, all of which were the perfect breeding ground for the plague. They also believed that residents were hiding sick family and friends, rightfully fearing racial backlash and poor treatment. Public health officials initiated a massive cleanup effort, but it was too little, too late, and the death toll continued to rise. Dr. Joseph J. Kinyon, a leader in disease prevention, wanted to warn San Francisco residents of impending infection. Politicians and business owners did not. A senator from San Francisco even stood on the Senate floor and shouted that Dr. Kinyon should hang for spreading disinformation. These upstanding citizens, however, did not fear the disease. They feared economic loss, and a smear campaign to discredit Kinyon's reputation began in earnest. Newspapers claimed that the doctor and city health officials were spreading fear of plague in order to fleece taxpayers out of money. Meanwhile, government officials, including the governor himself, denied the outbreak even existed. Doing otherwise, they feared, would undoubtedly harm the state's produce industry, worth over $40 million. Governor Henry Gage proposed that it be made a crime for anyone to publish reports or articles about the plague outbreak without express written permission from the California Board of Health. Dr. Kinyon, of course, would never receive such permission. Over the next 14 months, the city covered up more deaths. Plague or not, the public was beginning to panic, and many blamed the Chinese community for the outbreak. In April of the following year, United States Surgeon General Dr. Walter Wyman ordered Dr. Kinyon to leave San Francisco. Though Gage continued to protest, some, like the governor of Texas, didn't believe him. He threatened to stop all trade with California until they had the outbreak under control and asked federal investigators to step in. Gage intended to declare the state had eradicated the disease, if only to save face. But in early July, another resident of Chinatown died, and by summer's end, a dozen more were dead. The federal government descended to investigate and began to prove Governor Gage was covering up the truth. Gage insisted the federal government was wrong and that men had died from syphilis. But as more deaths occurred, voters were losing faith in him, and they showed their disapproval by voting against him in the 1902 election. The succeeding governor, George Pardee, eventually put an end to the epidemic in 1904.
Grim and Mild presents The Wild West was executive produced by me, Aaron Mankey, and hosted by Aaron Mankey and Alexandra Steed. Writing for this season was provided by Michelle Muto, with research by Alexandra Steed, Sam Alberti, Cassandra De Alba, and Harry Marks. Fact-checking was performed by Jamie Vargas, with sensitivity reading by Stacey Partial Jensen. Production assistance was provided by Josh Thane, Jesse Funk, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. To learn more about this and other shows from Grim and Mild and iHeartRadio, visit grimandmild.com.